Welcome to Under the Fig Tree podcast. In today's episode, hosts Reverend Micah Glenn and Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt sit down with a special guest as they meditate under the fig tree.
What's up? Welcome back once again to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. I am your host, Reverend Micah Glenn, the Director of Recruitment here at Concordia Seminary, always joined by my highly esteemed co-host, Dr. Ben Haupt. How are you doing today, bro?
I'm good. We have a thing for later on in the episode. We actually found figs on campus. We remembered. And
I don't know if they're edible, but
we both, but we're going to try to eat them.
we did bring them along.
We each brought one. And by the end of the episode, we will take a bite. Okay. So I feel like one of those podcasters that's like, watch the entire episode and wait until the end. And
I'm not going to lie. I did not pick that anticipating you saying that, but you know.
Oh, you're going to take
you've baited me in. Yeah. I'm here for it. It's not going to kill me. Right. So anyway, you know, when I do the introduction, you know, you have things running in your mind, and I almost always call myself Reverend Doctor because I have it in my mind that that's the direction I'm going, and I like the sound of it, but not yet. Anyway.
That is the direction you're going.
We are joined by a Reverend Doctor, Reverend Dr. David Lewis. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah. And you've been a guest. This is now your third time.
Yeah, I think I was with you guys. We went over a chapter of Titus.
Yeah, back in the early days of Under the Fig Tree.
Then we did the parable of the automatic seed from Mark chapter 4.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I feel like we did a couple because there's like three short ones in a row.
Yeah. But that's my favorite parable. So
okay. That series we did on Titus, I think, was like the first time we were like, let's do a thing, and we picked a pastoral epistle. And if I'm like thinking about myself reflecting as a podcaster, I think that's probably when we began to hit our stride.
Yeah, a little bit. It was a good. Yeah, if you just started watching us on YouTube, you can go back, and we have two seasons on platforms, the Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and we did a series through Titus, and then we did another series through the parables in the New Testament.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you joined us for both, and we asked you for very specific reasons. Well, first, because you're a language professor here at the seminary, and you teach the New Testament.
Yes.
And both of those were in the New Testament, not because we only read the New Testament, but, you know. The parables and the pastoral epistles are both in the New Testament.
Yes, they are. Yeah,
by coincidence. but you teach Greek. We've talked about that before. I had you as a Greek student. You had me as a Greek student.
Yeah, back in 2011
when I started the seminary.
Which I think a 98 on the final test on the qualifier.
I'll take the praise.
I remember that.
I love the languages. They're so good, and I love languages. Period. But once you can communicating with people in their tongue and having that ability, not that I tell people all the time, they ask me if I can speak in Hebrew and Greek, and the answer is no.
Although there are some people on our campus that are trying to get after that, not Hebrew so much yet, but definitely Greek and Latin.
Dr. David Maxwell has been doing his live Greek. He's been able to teach it in the Greek lab a few times, and he's doing it this winterum. And I've got a couple summer Greek students who are planning to, take that as an elective.
Yeah.
And where they, this could be controversial, but I think there probably is some value in this. But Dr. James Veltz, who wrote the grammar we use, he said, "Yeah, it's real helpful if you want to go to some Greek island and interact with the people." and he takes part in the at Society of Biblical Literature. There's like a spoken Greek section where they try to perform in Greek, and his general attitude is, he doesn't think it's all that helpful. In other words, we ought to be learning the grammar to read the text.
Yeah,
and I can read the New Testament, but I don't speak Greek either. I read aloud the Greek of the New Testament. I wouldn't mind learning Greek.
Yeah.
Modern Greek, but Koine Greek is not the Greek being spoken.
Nope.
Yeah.
If our listeners or viewers want something entertaining and they know a little bit about Dr. Jim Veltz, watching Dr. Maxwell's presentation at our most recent symposium, and then listening especially to Dr. Veltz's remarks after his presentation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was kind of like two worlds colliding and two great, great minds who both love the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions, but have very different ideas about how we should learn languages and how languages work. And neither of them, let's just say, neither of them are slouches. Maxwell is, Veltz obviously wrote the textbook, Fundamental Greek Grammar. Maxwell is translating all this stuff from Cyril out of the Greek.
Well, Dr. Veltz also wrote our hermeneutics book.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and two volumes on the Gospel of Mark.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which Sam, I think was your doctoral.
Yeah, he was my doctor father. So I'm a little biased towards him. We had a member of the Board of Regents sit in on my present hermeneutics class.
Oh, sure.
And I asked the question. So just, you know, he said, "Oh, you guys do Veltz?" And I said, "Yeah." And then I said, "Do I like Veltz?" And they're all, "Yes," you know, everybody just erupted, and it's like, okay, you know. And I said, "Do I agree with him all the time?" They're all, "No," you know. But you definitely love him, you know. And he's my doctor father, and I would say probably the most important teacher I've ever had in my life. And
sure.
So I think what was that, Green and Gold Follies, when I was in Celebrity Jeopardy, the announcer said that I was into all things Veltz, and I said, "Well, yeah." He wrote the grammar. He wrote the commentaries on Mark. He wrote the hermeneutics book. He wrote all the stuff that I teach.
Right.
So, you know, but David Maxwell is no slouch in Greek either.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, he's kind of a giant, I think.
Yeah.
And translating Gospel of John from Cyril.
Yeah.
I think he's producing his own grammar on Cyril's Greek.
Right.
He and I have had a lot of conversations about, you know, the translation choices he makes. But they do not agree on how the languages should be taught.
So I have a friend looking at becoming a pastor, and he's looking ahead, and he's like talking about Greek. Is there a way I could get a head start on Greek? And I was like, well, there is an online class that you can pay for. I'll say this. I was like, there are different grammars, and I was like, because my wife Dorothy took Greek at Concordia Chicago, and they use Manchin.
Manchin, yeah. Right.
Which is a different grammar, and people like Manchin for different reasons. I was like, but I was like, I learned Greek at the seminary. So Dorothy had ideas about Greek, and she was trying to help me along. I started to take Greek here at the seminary, and then, you know, the order of how things are taught are different. I was like, and that's significant. I was like, now having learned from Veltz, I was like, I think his order is right.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of the differences because I think this is a really interesting episode for me, because for those of our viewers, listeners that are thinking about coming to seminary, they know probably that languages are a big deal, not only for our future pastoral students, but also even a lot of deaconess students, and certainly a lot of grad students need to take Greek and Hebrew. So let's talk a little bit about some of the differences. So with learning Greek, one thing is a pronunciation, right? There are differing pronunciations, and Veltz has some specific thoughts on that, right?
Yes, he does. And it's interesting, if you read chapter 1, that's where he talks about the diphthongs.
Yep.
And
Now, what's a diphthong?
A diphthong is any two vowels that come together. And it's really, in Greek, it's one open vowel, one close vowel that come together and make a single sound.
Yep.
And so like in English, we have these. You have an O and an I, oi, mm-hmm. right, the two. And then you have an A and an I together, I, E-I, A. The same phenomenon occurs in Greek. There's a number of diphthongs that are pretty much identical to the English diphthongs, same pronunciation. And what Dr. Veltz does is he has in the text a pronunciation for two diphthongs, and then in the footnote, an alternate pronunciation.
Yep.
And it's the continental pronunciation versus, I guess, the English-American pronunciation. And then when he teaches Greek, he goes with his footnote. When I teach Greek, I go with the text, because that's what I learned originally. I didn't learn from Veltz's book. I learned from Machen
Sure.
Originally. And then when Dr. Veltz got his call to come to Concordia, I went on vicarage that next year, and I had a feeling he was going to become the big Greek guy. And so this shows, I guess, what a language nerd I am. I bought a copy of his Fundamental Greek Grammar. This is like the first edition.
Sure.
Where the print looked like it just came out of a computer. It was not, yeah.
Yeah.
And part of my daily devotions, this may sound bad, is I read through his grammar while on vicarage. You know, I did translated a chapter of Hebrew every day. I always preached on the gospel. That's the only gospel the pastor would let me preach on. Mm-hmm. So I'd read the gospel texts in Greek, mm-hmm. and then I would study Veltz's grammar. And this is what I found. This is a difference between the two grammars, at least. Machen tended to present the paradigms, and there'd be some explanation, but not a lot. And so I found I'd learn the paradigms, forget the paradigms, learn the paradigms, forget the paradigms, because there was no method, there was no reason for why they were that way. And what Veltz does in chapters 3 and 4 is he explains the nature of the Greek verb as stem, connecting, vowel, and ending.
Yep.
And my dad was an engineer. I think I've got that mind. As soon as I understood how all the parts come together, bang, I never forgot the paradigms again. And then nouns, stem plus ending, once it's like, oh, it was that simple. And then his take on aspect in his chapter 9, how the present stem works, especially in the imperfect.
Right.
I was taught the imperfect is always just continuous progressive action. You know, so it'd be elepon. You know, I was leaving, mm-hmm. and I remember reading the text, and the imperfect doesn't always make sense that way.
Yeah.
And then I read chapter 9, and suddenly, bang, and I had one class with Veltz, New Testament Eisegetics 2, which was in the old curriculum, two curriculums ago. And after reading just the first 9 chapters of his book, I suddenly understood Greek so much better. Hmm. And so I kind of knew this is the guy I'm going to, when I go into the PhD program, this is the guy I want to study under.
Yeah. Any one of us could say this, but so Dr. Veltz did his PhD over in Cambridge.
Yes.
And his dissertation on research was he looked at and evaluated every infinitive.
Imperative.
Imperative in the New Testament.
Yes.
And this is where his present stem nuance came from. He's like, you could always use a past tense or aorist stem
right.
in an infinitive. Why are they using a present tense? I keep saying infinitive, imperative.
Imperative.
So why are they using a present tense one? And all of these things that came on. So I took them for Greek readings and for a lectionary class. And see, you sit at the feet of right. giants at this institution. Yeah, and so when I'm translating Greek and I see an imperative in a present tense, I stop and I say, what's happening here? I just right. don't say.
Just translate it as a command.
Like, yeah, exactly. Right. Like, loose this or go this way. It's like, why is it present tense? And then you start reading around it.
And yeah, that's chapter 32 of Fundamental Greek Grammar where he does the imperatives. That was his dissertation. And so I've sat in on him teaching Greek. And he's actually apologized for that chapter a few times.
Okay.
Because it's so close to his heart.
Mm. Oh.
That he wonders if he's giving too much information. You know, like, you know, the infinitive chapter is not quite as long. You know, it's got a good introduction, but it's not quite as long as the imperative chapter. And his whole distinction between specified case
right.
commands and policy commands. I always try to sell the students on that whenever we get to chapter 32.
I bought it.
I did, too. This past summer, I think, just about it. This first year class, they're awesome. It just shows me that we're getting smarter people than we were when we came, you know. And
that's what we want.
And it's like they just sort of seem to get it, you know. Usually people like I don't care, just it's a command.
Sure.
And these guys are. I just got a question today from one of our first year students about a Bible passage, and he's asking, "Is this a policy command?" Mm. I got a feeling this is a policy command, you know. And mm-hmm. And I wrote back, "Yeah, probably is," you know.
Look at that.
And he said, "So we should be paying attention to this still today." And I said, "Yeah, you know." So like a specified case command would be when Jesus tells the paralytic, "Arise, take your bed and go."
Yep.
You know, in other words, that's not a sign of Christianity that we all lay around on mattresses and then get up, pick our mattress up and go somewhere.
Yeah.
But when he says, you know, deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me, that's likely more in a policy situation.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, of course, which is the present imperative in that group? It's not deny yourself. That's aorist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not take up your cross. It's follow me.
Right.
Where you got suddenly a present imperative, which implies it means something, right? That's where Eumaika would be reading along and, Why does he switch to a present imperative right here?
Exactly.
There's some meaning to this.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think what this illustrates for people who might have not yet studied Greek or any languages and are kind of like, whoa, lots of conversation going on that I don't understand, is this is the richness of the scriptures. And yeah. And it's the change from just reading through the scriptures in English and kind of taking the translator's word for it.
Right.
And you know, you have ESV or NIV, and they have differences, and I think everybody, all Christians that have spent any mm-hmm. time reading the Bible know that, but how do they get these differences? Why these differences? And it's the exciting opportunity to... It's the difference, I've heard it said, of watching a football game on a standard black and white television or watching it in color, high def.
Oh, Bells would say being at the game on the 50-yard line,
right,
about... Yeah. 40 yards. So you don't want to be right on the field. You want to sit back a little bit so you can see all the action unfolding.
Yeah, yeah.
He's very specific in where you're sitting watching the game.
Yeah, that's his model is, watching on a black and white TV at home versus watching there. And it's not like watching on the TV, you're getting a different game. In other words, the Rams still win,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Or can you still talk about the Rams?
The Rams are not winning at the moment.
Okay,
anyway.
I know. I'm just, they were my team because I grew up in Southern Cal, but, sure. But you miss so much else going on the field because the camera's focused usually on where the ball is, not on,
the guy doing
a penalty over on the side over here.
Yeah.
And now my model is, I think Veltz is good, but he actually told me once that my model's better.
Okay.
And it's, I'm a film guy. And
right.
So reading the English text is like watching a film formatted for your TV,
mm-hmm.
right, where they... Yeah, it's not the big rectangular cinescope, but they cut stuff out to fit it into the square box.
Yeah.
Now we got all these modern televisions that are rectangles, but back in the day it was just that square versus watching a film, I would say, in a theater on widescreen.
Mm.
Because the original director intended you not just to see the middle, but all this other stuff on the side.
Yeah.
And to actually put that into television, you have to make decisions what you're going to cut out.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And so again, it's the same movie. Ben-Hur wins the chariot race, even when it's formatted to fit your TV. But you've never seen the chariot race from Ben-Hur until you've watched it widescreen, on a big screen. Or, we can do that at home. There's so much you miss, and especially the greatest directors, they have the whole rectangle planned out, what they want you to see. And sometimes you may miss like stuff, and then the next time you see it, you say, I didn't see that before. But formatted to fit your TV, you miss so much. And that's the English translation. It's good.
Yeah.
But the translators have to make decisions. So that imperfect, is it supposed to be progressive? I was leaving, or is
habitual?
It I tried to leave, or yeah. habitual. I used to leave. And they have to make a decision, and in making that decision, they cut it down.
Yep.
And so Veltz once told me, he said, that's a better metaphor because you actually have the translation going when you're cutting from widescreen to full screen.
Well, as a student of both of you, I would probably say it's also getting the cuts that they have to leave out.
Yeah.
And so I'm
right, because translators have to make decisions.
They have to make decisions.
And so... I'm a big Marvel fan.
Oh yeah, right.
My favorite character.
I was wondering. I was going
to follow his Thor.
Is this something that always comes into these discussions?
Oh, always. Yeah. Always. Okay. Well, you're not Star even going Wars, where Marvel. I was going to go. Okay.
So. Well, so the most recent film, Thor: Love and Thunder.
Right.
Excellent, by the way. If you have Disney Plus and you haven't watched it, what are you doing with your life? But what didn't make it into the movie is, so they have like the kind of origin scenes for gore. But in the extended cuts, apparently there's a whole series of how he becomes the God Killer beyond that little garden. No spoilers, but and they had to leave that out because you only have so much time as well. And I can't, as time progresses, I'm like, filmmakers, like, I think we've paid a lot of money to sit here. I'll stay here for 3.5 hours if you can keep me there for 3.5 hours.
That's an excellent metaphor too. So now we got the released version is more like a translation than the director's cut. And so I would say reading the New Testament and the Greek is like attending the game live,
yep.
sitting,
yep.
you know, sitting wherever you're supposed to be sitting. It's like watching a film full screen, and then it's like watching a film full screen with the director's cut, with those other scenes that he intended you to see that translators, it's just translation. They have to make these choices. This is why we want our students to study Greek and Hebrew. So
makes a better preacher and teacher.
Yep. They can bring, as Veltz would say, take your people to the game.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's
And that's what I was gonna say is you know, for Christians who are reading their English Bible, that it is sufficient for salvation. Still gonna hear that Jesus Christ died on the cross for you for the forgiveness of your sins.
Yep.
Beginning to understand the nuances of how Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John tell that story of Jesus' death is one kind of further, a little bit deeper, and we should talk about narrative criticism here at some point too, because we could go down that yeah. direction. But then the languages give you even further richness in your reading, and it's especially when you need to be a teacher of it.
Yeah.
That so not all Christians need necessarily to study Greek and Hebrew, obviously, but it's a great thing. It's a great opportunity to grow in faith.
People, I get asked, what's my favorite translation? And I'm always like, well, I have problems with all the ones that you're thinking of. I was like, my favorite translation usually is the one that I've done from the Greek or Hebrew into English, because I'm looking at the text, I'm studying the grammar, I'm looking at a lexicon, because not every Greek or Hebrew word has an English word that it can mean. Oftentimes, you have choices,
right? Yep.
And then yep. you're looking at the choices, and you're like, okay, like it could mean this, 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 or this, and you look around it. And again, I'm not a Greek or Hebrew scholar, but you know, you get taught how to approach these things, and you make a decision, and then you know, you write a sermon based upon kind of the commentary you've got from practicing translating the language. And it just takes your preaching and teaching skills and messages a little deeper for your people. So if you're listening and you're not a pastor and you've read the English Bible and you're like, my pastor said this, but I'm looking at the text and it says nothing about what he's talking about,
right?
Because there's motion from these languages that doesn't necessarily translate into English all the time.
Yeah.
I'm proud to hear that, because one of my goals as a language teacher is that my students would get to that point where they're not really happy with any English translation.
Sure.
Right? And the point is, again, once what you said, Ben, is true, the English translations are good. You're still getting the gospel narrative. But for those who are going to be professional teachers, preachers, I love to hear it when my students say, you know, I'm not really happy with any translation, but the one I work out,
yeah.
and people say, you know, people have asked me, what's your favorite translation? I said, it depends on the verse. There are some places where I think the NIV nails it, and other yeah. places where it falls short.
Yeah.
Some places where the ESV nails it, and so they'll say, so what is your favorite translation? I said, you know, in the end, it's mine. Yeah. And they're all, well, that's kind of arrogant. And I said, well, not really, because I'm the one who's got to preach this sermon.
Right.
And I want to make sure, you know, if the NIV, you know, they translate unclean spirit as evil spirit, I want to say unclean spirit. I'm going to disagree with the NIV on that one.
Yeah.
And I think it changes the nature of the story.
Right.
We're not dealing with spirits that are evil, they are, but spirits that contaminate the people they possess.
Right.
Yeah.
Jesus is saving them from that kind of cosmic impurity.
Mm.
That's, you know,
it's a different a different nuance to the evil,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
This is
yeah.
an evil that contaminates.
Yeah,
you know, and yeah,
changes the way you look at sin.
Yeah, it changes the way. Yeah, and then suddenly you realize why you know, the whole purity is not a big deal among us Americans. We might be interested in whether our chicken has hormones,
right?
But purity is a big deal almost in every other culture.
Right.
You know, you talk about Middle East, Africa, Asia, and. And so they actually hear gospel in the words, Jesus has cleansed us. Right. He's yeah. driven out the impurity. And that would be a place where the ESV made a translation decision that I really don't like.
Hmm.
But then other places, their translations, I think, are pretty cool.
Do you find that students coming into class, they've memorized certain passages of Scripture, right? Yeah. This is part of like catechism,
right?
This is part of Lutheran education or just kind of Christian formation. A lot of pastors have their members memorize Scripture, and then are they kind of like initially scandalized when they're like coming into class and they're like, wait, I learned this passage this way, and now all of a sudden you're saying the translation is not quite right.
Well, it's like John 3:16, the so-called gospel in a nutshell, which is actually it's a subordinate clause to John 3:14 and 15, right? It's explaining, you know, why is, you know, Jesus makes a comparison between the raising of the serpent on the pole, you know, what Moses did, and the Son of Man being lifted up, and then you have, for God so loved the world, and the word so could also be translated in this way. Yeah. God loved the world in this way, namely, he gave his only son, right?
Versus rather than like so much.
Yeah. And it's actually, the word could be read either way.
Yeah.
And everybody wants it. God loved the world so much, which is possible. And then you get someone like me or, you know, Jeff Gibbs I agree with him on this translation, Dr. Jeff Gibbs, another one of my great teachers, that, you know, God loved the world in this way. This is the way he did
it. Kind of thus.
Yeah, thus. And
pointing back to 14
and 15. And then students get scandalized and... Then I said, well, this is John, so it could be a double entendre, right?
Yeah.
Which John likes to do. And then Ephesians 2, verse 8, for by grace you are saved, and, you know, we make a big deal. That's a perfect, right?
Yeah.
Past act, present result. So have been, and as a result, are now in a saved condition. So not are being saved right now, but have been, and now you're in the saved state. So by grace you have been saved through faith, and this— Right.
What's the zit? What is this?
What does this refer to?
It's tauta, right?
It's tauta. It's a tuta. It's a neuter.
Oh, yeah.
A tuta. And if I ask the English speakers, so what is this referring to? They all say faith, right? This faith is not of yourselves. It's a gift of God. And they've heard it preached that way,
right?
Even by Missouri Synod preachers. And then I say, faith is a feminine noun.
Yeah.
Tuta is a neuter.
That's right.
Pronoun.
If it was tauta, you could say faith, but since it's tuta.
It's tuta.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not faith. And you look, there's nothing neuter before. And so it's the whole
package.
Shebang, the whole package. Getting saved by grace through faith. This whole thing is not of yourselves. And then in the Greek, it's not, it is a gift of God. It's really, you know, theou comes before gift. So theou doron, not doron to theou, and so it's a gift of God, but really in the Greek it's God's gift. It is. Yeah, we're emphasizing God. You know, so it's really, you have to translate that. For by grace you have been saved by means of faith. You know, so by means of grace you are in a saved state right now through faith, and this whole thing, right, getting saved by grace through faith, is not of you. It's God's gift, with emphasis upon God's, and that would be watching Scripture in the widescreen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, English translations lose some stuff in translation.
It would have tremendous implications then for a question like, I had some evangelical friends in high school that would ask me, so when were you saved, right? And when they talk about that, it was this kind of historical moment, and they want to know, like, you know, when did you make your decision is the big question that they're asking, right? Which kind of goes against this passage in a major way. But it also kind of treats that, for grace I was saved, as kind of a past event that, you know, may or may not have any implications for your present life.
Right.
And the way that you just explained it, makes a lot more sense of kind of our Lutheran understanding of salvation. It's outside of our choice,
right?
And it's something that didn't just happen. Of course, baptism happens to us, and it's a historical event. But the reason that we remember our baptism is because it's a continuing present reality.
And you have baptism earlier in Ephesians 2. The whole, you've been made alive with Christ, you've been raised with him, you've been seated with him in the heavenly realms, whatever that means, in the spiritual realm, but those are all aorists, past tense. And so, and I think Paul's referring to baptism. When was I made alive? When was I raised? And then really, I think we could say, when was I seated with Christ in the heavenly realms? And that was at baptism.
But it's a continuing right. present reality. But
yeah, that's the past act. What's the present result?
Yeah.
I'm in a saved condition.
In my historical baptism, I was grafted into this narrative that happened a long time ago, but continues on today.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things where, like, of course, we're Lutheran, so naturally we're right. But I've experienced this, and I'm sure you have as well, when you're talking to somebody who's Christian or maybe perhaps de-churched. I encountered a ton of de-churched people when I worked in Ferguson who grew up in the church, thought they had a good understanding of the gospel and Christian life, and then I explain it this way, the gospel from a Christian perspective. Well, let's talk about your baptism and what it actually means and what you've been connected to, and you see a bulb click on.
Yeah.
And now they're like, and I'm not saying this, the fact that we're saved through our baptism, apart from ourselves, apart from our works, is a license to sin, but they begin to see all of their sin in a different way, that it is actually forgiven through Jesus' work and not my ability to live a perfect life. And it transforms the way, again, people see themselves, the way they see life, the way they see others, and it gives them, now they understand this new life that Paul is talking about in Ephesians 2.
Right.
But you have to have that whole package. It can't be according to any part of me, because if it is according to any part of me naturally, it falls apart.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it is God's gift for us is just such a huge thing, and that's why the language just...
Yeah. Verse 10, we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to perform good works that he prepared in advance that we would walk in them. And it's all God. Even the new life is all God. That's one reason why we call that a Lutheran verse, because it's hard to get around Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 10.
Right.
And I would say 8 through 10, because verse 10 brings in the new obedience, which is also God's work in us. And I agree, because if it was me, it ain't going to work.
No. You know?
And I had an evangelical friend back in college who actually made the decision for Christ numerous times.
Yeah.
Almost every time she went to, like one of those revival preaching thing, she would get up and offer and do the altar call again and again, because she was never certain that the last one took.
Right.
Right, because if it's up to me, I mean, I know myself well enough. I have good days and bad days.
Yeah, I know, right?
I ask my wife. She knows very well. I have good days and bad days. Days where I feel like I'm just absolutely certain, and everything that I'm doing is I'm just 100% on board. And then I have days where I'm just completely disillusioned, and I'm like, why did I do that? And if it were up to us, salvation would be a pretty tenuous, could be a pretty scary thing. That's why I'm actually grateful for my wife, because her love for me doesn't change. It doesn't go up and down. We've been married now for almost 20 years, but God's love is even in Christ is much more certain than that.
Yeah. So we've been talking about languages, and so again, if you're going to come residentially, Greek and Hebrew are. You got to do them. And I don't want to say you got to do them, because again, even if you struggle through the languages, I know guys that in class that everybody there's different levels of people being able to approach a foreign language, especially one that isn't modern, and wrap their minds around it well enough to not simply take a test, but operate in this language moving forward, because it's not like you take Greek and we're just seeing if you can learn it and you put your Nestle Island away.
Yeah.
You take Greek and then you open it up for the rest of the four
What's
years.
What's a
of
Nestle Island?
It's the version of the Greek New Testament that we highlight here at the seminary. And there are different versions. But even beyond CSL, so I got the 28 might no longer be the latest version.
It still is.
Okay, they were the 28 had just come out when I was studying at Westfield House, and I wasn't a New Testament student, so I didn't necessarily get one for free. But I got one while I was a student there. And it's just the Nestle and Allen are two guys an organization.
Two German dudes.
Yeah.
Who are
Eberhard Nestle, is that right?
Yeah.
And Kurt Aland?
Kurt, yeah.
That are
both German dudes that
smart. Kurt Aland's wife, I think, was into this
right.
textual critic as well.
Yeah.
And they have a big team. Talk about being scandalized, and I might have said this before, but I remember getting to Greek, and the first thing you get your Greek grammar, you get your Greek New Testament, and you're ready to go. And I remember flipping it open, and I remember seeing the apparatus, and,
yeah.
and I remember you talking about it, and I said, well, what is this apparatus? And you were like, well, it's all the variants of the text. And I was like, what do you mean the variants of the text?
Right.
And then, like, you know, in hindsight, it only makes sense, right?
Yeah.
When people talk about biblical inerrancy, nothing gets held to the standard that the Bible does.
Right.
For in any manuscript in the history of humanity. But you're like, this is where, like, you know, scribes or different versions scandalized for about 30 seconds, got over it. I was like, well, let's move forward and actually understand what this means. And so they compile all of this information. I'm sure now they have this digital database that they probably compare things with, and they actually make the same type of moves we're talking about for the ESV or
where you make decisions.
You have all these manuscripts, and you're looking at the manuscript, and there's histories of different scribes and manuscripts that we know well, and they look at text, and they look at the history of the text, and in the main body of the Greek Testament that they compile together, they've made choices of which ones to include, and they always make a mark if they've made one of those choices, especially when they differ, but they include those variations in an apparatus, so they're not just saying, this is the original text. They're saying, we think, based upon our history and our experience, that this is probably the closest main text, but here are the ones where it differs. Now you get to make a choice.
It's kind of like the Supreme Court, right? So we have our Constitution in the United States, but we need somebody to say, well, this is essentially what this document means. And in this particular case, so my doctoral supervisor, Hugh Houghton, is now on the editorial committee for the Editio Critica Maior, the big critical edition of the Greek New Testament, and he makes decisions on what is the actual text of this verse.
So your dissertation was in text criticism. Right?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say of Nestle Allen, that's a nice analogy. But we're here, the scholars able to disagree with the Supreme Court.
Sure.
So now, if we're lawyers, we get to say, yeah, they decided Miranda, but I'm going to determine now that he didn't need to know that his confession, he didn't have to confess, you know. And but here we could actually look at the evidence down below and decide, you know, I think they made a mistake here, and I'm going to go with this reading. So the 25th edition of Nestle Aland, you know, Mark 1:1, you know, you have the Arche Evangeliou Iesu Christou, and then Huiu Theou, Son of God, was down in the apparatus, right? So they didn't read Son of God. They just had the beginning of the Gospel of Christ.
Right.
And then they thought that, you know, they went with the original hand of Codex Sinaiticus, which doesn't have it. And most evangelical scholars continued to read it as part of the text. It didn't matter what Nestle Aland said. But then now in the 27th edition, they put it back up above in single brackets to determine there's a disagreement about this, but now they read it. And it's kind of interesting what changed. I think it really has to do with people started reading more of Mark, you know. Mark, in other words, they're saying it's more likely someone added Son of God to up the Christology than took it out, right? And now the conclusion is, well, actually, you know, you read Mark, the Christology is pretty high.
Right.
The main title of Jesus is Son of God, right? You're wondering who knows that he's the Son of God. And the only human is the centurion at the foot of the cross, which is another reason why I'm Lutheran, you know. It's at the cross that Jesus proves his sonship.
Yeah.
But then you realize, it probably was original. And now I think they say, yeah, likely the copyist of Codex Sinaiticus made a mistake, right? And I know you've probably seen it. It's Son of God is actually it's in between the lines, carried it in sort of where it's supposed to be,
right.
And by the first corrector of that text.
And is it a nomina sacra? Is it shortened?
Yeah. So they have the it's abbreviated.
So a nomina sacra is an abbreviation. So kind of like you'd see the Cairo,
right,
which is the X with then a large P,
right?
But that's actually an R or a
row, yeah, it's an R
in Greek. But those are the first two letters of Christos.
Right.
So the writers would abbreviate it as they're writing Greek. They would abbreviate something.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times in Christou. They'll do the chi and then the ypsilon, the last letter.
The first and last letter of the
name. And then tilde, is that right?
So it's
over the top that kind of signifies, hey, this is an abbreviation.
Yeah. So huiu theihu is then ypsilon theta and then ypsilon. Yeah, which is then
ink and paper used to be expensive, right?
Yeah, I know. So, and they were using parchment. I think that was animal hide, and papyrus and parchment were pretty expensive. So,
if you can say space.
Yeah, I think Jeff Kloh and then J.E. Keith Elliott, who's a world-renowned text critic, and Kloh is our text critic, I'd say the chief text critic of our denomination. They were characterizing it like, Codex Sinaiticus, the copyist went through one day and did all that, and then his boss came and said, "You missed son of God," and pins it in. He pins it into the line, that very day maybe.
Yeah.
And but that would be a place where even Nestle Aland will change what they read from edition to edition. And then if there's a text that they don't think is real, but it's been so important in the history of the church, they put it in the double brackets. And I don't want to scandalize anybody watching, but this would be like the long ending of Mark.
Sure. Right, right. So for our viewers or listeners,
even in English versions,
go to the English version of their Bible to the end of Mark and look at what their English version footnote says for Mark 16:9-20.
And I think ESV puts it in single brackets.
Mm,
yeah.
Probably.
And I think they do the same thing for the woman caught in adultery in John 7:8.
Yeah.
And
maybe the Kama Yohane.
Yeah, right. I don't know if that's included in any translations anymore.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's in the King James.
That's, it's in the King James. Yeah.
And I think I probably talk some about King James only folks because I've got some in my family.
Sure.
Where the King James, in other words, you don't need to learn Greek, just the read the authority. King James.
Yeah.
Yeah, the authority. Right. Yeah. The authorized version, they say.
Yeah.
It's authorized by King James, but they have this idea that it's authorized by God, historically. And everybody needs to learn English to read the Bible today.
Right.
Not only English, but
it's just an astounding theological claim that I've read some of these books. But it's to try to claim that this is somehow from God, that it's the authorized translation. I mean, even Luther, he's very open about how he translated the Greek New Testament into German, and he's defending certain things that he did. But I don't think he's ever claiming like divine, immediate inspiration.
Right.
He's arguing for his translation based on grammar.
Right.
If we're going to say it in German, we have to say it this way.
And this is what we would do as pastors if we got together for a study group. We might disagree on the grammar. I think that's a habitual imperfect. You're saying, no, I think it's inceptive, And one thing, I'll have students who will have a bit of a faith crisis when they find out about the variant readings. I remember that always comes up in Greek, and I'm always like, okay, should I even bother talking about this?
Yeah.
There goes another 20 minutes of class. But
a lifetime.
I would say, or a lifetime. But I know. But I say, our faith is an incarnational faith.
Right.
We believe that God took the risks of taking on human flesh and becoming one of us.
Yeah.
And the same thing in somehow the scriptures are not somehow less human than Jesus was.
Yeah.
But I find many Christians want the scriptures to be more divine than he is.
Right.
They're okay with Jesus having a human nature, but not scriptures. And one sign of the human nature of the scriptures is they were copied, and in the historical process, variant readings arose.
Yeah.
I actually find it today more comforting to me that, that it really, God really did take on human flesh. And my own look at Jesus and the narrative is that the risk is things are going to happen that even he didn't plan on. That may sound shocking, but I think when the Canaanite woman in Matthew 15 comes to Jesus, I personally don't think he's refusing her to test her faith. I think he's refusing her because she's a Canaanite, and he came for Israel.
Yeah.
And her faith wins him over.
Imagine.
In other words, in a way, she's kind of the hero of that text. kind of right. the way the woman with the hemorrhage who touches Jesus is sort of the hero of the text. He wasn't planning on getting touched, and she touches him, and suddenly, you know, and that's the risk God takes when he takes on human flesh. And so you might say Great Commission ministry is taking place before the Great Commission when Jesus cast the demon out of the Canaanite woman's daughter. And this was, I don't think he was planning to do it. I think she won him over. And I actually think that's kind of comforting, not to have the sovereign Lord of the Calvinists. And I believe God is sovereign. So
yeah, of course.
But the Father of Jesus, who actually listens to my prayers,
yeah.
It might even change his mind because David asked him, you know. And that's
oh, even
know, the guy who took yeah. on human flesh and still is in flesh today that I can have a beer with someday in the resurrection. If he likes beer, you know,
right.
Or wine, better, wine, right?
For
yeah,
sure, yeah.
Wine, yeah. To me, that's just mind-blowing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's even like, you could do this in the Old Testament. You could do it yeah. with Jonah, yep. right? Where yeah. God is going to destroy Nineveh. They repent, and he says, all right, well,
yeah.
never mind. Jonah's frustrated.
Yeah.
But God's will is accomplished. The same thing with Abraham for Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, what if there's 10? What if there's 30? And God's willing to entertain this, but in the end, there weren't.
Right.
And so it's one of these things where having conversations with people on inerrancy and which version and things like that, I always try to remind them, again, of the blessings of our time in history, because think of, you have the context is always important. I say for most of the history of the church, people like you and me wouldn't have been able to read any version of the scriptures.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And so... don't worry about the things that aren't necessarily unimportant, but are unimportant in the grand scale of what we're gathered around. It's a tremendous blessing to be able to read. I mean, I was going to say a version of the Bible I don't care for, but if that's what you have, that is what you have. I think probably God's will can be accomplished even through nonsense at times. But it's just one of these things where, again, what is it that we're gathered around, and what is it that is being preached, and what is it being communicated, whether it's written or spoken, is the thing. And it has to be Jesus, him crucified for your sins. And that's what we're trying to get at in all of this,
right.
For the sake of people's salvation.
So I'm definitely charged up to get back into my Greek New Testament. But for our listeners, our viewers who have not ever studied Greek or Hebrew, and they're thinking, you know, when I come to seminary the summer before the program starts, I'm going to do kind of the Greek boot camp at seminary. But what could they do right now? What are some good things to do? Would you recommend that they get the Greek grammar and start to do it on their own, or what would be some things that a prospective student who's kind of jazzed up after listening to this and says, I really want to dig in, where do I even start?
And I would I think getting ahead is always a good thing.
Yep.
You can actually find some lectures by Jim Veltz, Dr. Veltz, who wrote the book. I think they're available through Concordia Theology.
I think they're on CSL Scholar, right?
CSL yes. Scholar.
Scholar.csl.edu, yeah. And right. then if you search Veltz, V-O-E-L-Z,
yep.
you can find them there.
And I'll have had students, some students who've come here have actually taken his year-long course, I think, where they meet once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets them ahead. Some guys will watch Veltz, I would say, usually up through like chapter 10. And so they kind of at least coast the first couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I would say, if anything, probably the best thing you can do is get the grammar and study chapter 1, get the alphabet down,
yeah.
Go on to chapter 2, get the accents down. And that right there would give that first day where we spend all 3 hours just going through the alphabet, the diphthongs, syllable division. If you get that down and that first day, you're going to have the base to continue. Dr. Veltz argues, he thinks if you don't get chapter 1 down, you're never really going to master the language.
Mm.
You know those guys who never really learn to pronounce, and then we have them read the sentence, and it's like,
yeah,
dude, man, now we got to go. You should go back to chapter 1 and start over again. But
so what's the name of the grammar again?
It is Fundamental Greek Grammar I think now it's fourth edition revised.
And that's important. There are, as our you know, as we all know, on Amazon, you can find every edition of every book now. So the first edition, the second edition, the third edition, even, don't buy them because you will be required to have the new edition.
There is in a fourth edition, too, and then the fourth edition revised. One other thing I would say, and this is good for both Greek and Hebrew, Dr. Veltz's grammar, he used to present a English for Greek students that used to be a separate handout. It is now in the fourth edition revised. And I would advise just go and restudy English, because one of the biggest problems students have in learning Greek is they don't know English.
Right, yeah.
And so when you talk about case, when you talk about tense of verbs, they're not really sure what those things mean already. They were taught that probably in grade school.
Like eighth grade or something. Yeah.
You know, I remember we even had to diagram sentences back in the eighth grade.
Yeah.
But you don't know about that stuff. And just relearning English.
Right.
And then he's actually got a review that's very helpful to get you thinking, okay, there's phrases, there's subordinate clauses, there's clauses, this is what case means, this is what tense means. And I think that would be one reason to get the book early. I would say study at least chapter one, and then read the Greek review, the English review for Greek students.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can find time to watch Veltz on CSL Scholar, if you could watch all of his lectures, that'd be great. You might even be able to take the qualifier and not have to take Summer Greek. But that's a big time commitment.
Yeah.
But at least watch him, I would say, through chapter 9.
Yeah.
And if you can, that will then set you up for the first 2 weeks where you will be ahead of the game. And
you have some idea of what's coming. I think a lot of times for languages, again, everybody in theory in America maybe was required to take a year or two of some foreign language in high school or something like that. But they're all different.
Yeah.
And so, again, now not just different from French or Spanish to English, where the alphabets are kind of similar. Now you have a new alphabet. And, again, case and things like that. And I think people just get overwhelmed and burdened by the idea. And they just get swallowed up with this ocean just because they're just intimidated by it. And I always tell people people ask me all the time, because we're getting less and less people that have Greek coming into the seminary. Just take a deep breath. Every student that we have in the seminary, we want everybody to succeed in everything that they do. We're not trying to weed people out with Greek. We're trying to help you through it.
Right.
And I would say, too, for if we have any viewers, listeners that are in high school and are thinking about where to go to college, there is nothing better that you can do with 4 years of college than spend time studying Greek and Hebrew.
Yeah.
You'll be way far ahead. There's a huge difference between taking Greek for 10 weeks versus taking it for 3 years, six semesters.
Yeah.
And so if you have the opportunity to take Greek and Hebrew in college, our Concordias definitely teach those. If not, have no fear. We will get you up to speed with Greek boot camp.
Yeah. And one other tool that we now have here is we use Logos, the Bible program, Logos. It's given. You end up buying it, but at a reduced cost. And with Logos, you can bring up the text, the Nestle Allen 28 text, or the BHS, which is the edition of the Hebrew Bible that scholars use, and basically the textual apparatus is there.
Mm-hmm.
Just with a click of a mouse and a symbol, you see all the variant readings. It parses verbs, gives you the definition of words. It's a really helpful tool, and I think students who learn the language in the summer and then start actively reading on Logos, they advance, they keep the languages. It takes some discipline, and I would say I love the Word of God, which is one reason why I love Greek and Hebrew. I actually believe that God is still speaking to us in the 66 canonical books of the Old and New Testament.
Yeah.
Even the antilogomena sometimes. But
I agree. Yeah, I agree. You don't have to sell me on that.
You had me for John and the Catholic Epistles where we talked about that stuff. Yeah. And
that's where
that was a great class. Yeah, that was a great class.
It was a great class. Yours was the very first class that you taught at seminary.
I know. Yeah, it was
ever
long
at
ago.
The old campus. I had him when he was a brand new prof. It was my last year.
Yeah.
It was a fun course.
You preached it. Well, as a graduate student, you preached a sermon on the blind man and going into the discourse. Good Shepherd discourse.
Yeah, Good Shepherd discourse.
I think I made the point that narratively, you should see the blind man still at Jesus' feet.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
when he launches in, because there's no division in the narrative between 9 and 10 and. Then he brought that up in his sermon, and I was just like, "Yeah, looking around." And then
nobody's ever said this before.
Nobody's ever said this before.
But my teacher told me it's true.
Nobody ever said this before. And I remember some people taking the Bibles out and like, "Oh, you know," and yeah, that was. But that gets into the narrative
yep.
approach,
oh,
which
right.
we tend to advocate here too.
One other piece of advice I would say is for somebody who did do the 10-week boot camp, if you are going to do a thing and you're trying to wrap your mind around the language, you mentioned it before because I'm a mathematician. Well, at least once upon a time before I became a pastor, I was a mathematician. My kids going through elementary school, bringing it back out slowly but surely. But Greek is very formulaic in how the words get formed. And it's a inflected language, meaning the form of a verb or a word determines what it means and what it's attached to
and how it
beyond
functions
itself.
In the sentence, right.
And so we talked about connecting vowels, ending. So every verb has a stem, a connecting vowel, and an ending. And if you begin to wrap your mind around that for the verbs as they begin to change, as they become participles and things like that, it'll be less overwhelming if you understand the formula of the language. Even nouns and things like that have a formula to them. Hebrew's a little bit different. It works differently, but Greek itself, German is like the modern engineering scientific language, but before there was German, there was Greek. And that's why you see Greek symbols all over math equations, because again, Greek is a formulaic language. And I would say I don't know if it ever breaks its rules for how they're formed. I'd have to go back through the grammar to figure that out. But I don't think that it does. If you learn the formula of how things get put together in Greek, you'll do well to
you'll
learn
do
the
well.
Language.
There's of course, there's the whole principal parts chart at the end of fundamental Greek grammar that goes through all the irregular verbs. And there are a number of irregular verbs, but...
But even in that, their stem changes, but the formula stays the same, depending on their tense and things like that.
So I would say, as way of advice on this line, if you could watch the Veltz videos, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Get his book, learn chapter one, get the vowels, get the alphabet, vowels, consonants, diphthongs down. And then Veltz himself says that the most important chapters in his book are chapters 3, where he presents the verbs, chapter 4, where he presents the nouns, chapter 9, which has to do with aspect, you know, how the present and aorist stems function, and then chapter 25, which is the perfect aspect.
Okay.
And I would say, study chapter 1, get the alphabet down, read his English review for Greek students, and then read the intros to chapters 3, 4, and 9. And those are the big theory chapters for Veltz. And then chapter 4, Mike, is what you're talking about with nouns. Inflected language, form determines function, not word order.
Right.
And so in English, it's all word order. In Greek, you have to look at the ending to know what a noun is doing.
Yep.
And then the rule, I don't think it ever violates the rules. It's just you find out later, you know, like the dative case has many different uses, not just indirect object. And and then it's all in its context, but it's easy. You can find the subject, look for that noun with a nominative ending. If it doesn't have a nominative ending, it's not the subject, even if it comes first.
Yep.
You know? So, and so I guess now I have to adapt my advice, get the book, get the alphabet down cold, and that would be the main thing.
Yeah.
Then I would say go to the end, find English Review for Greek students, read that, relearn English, and then if you have time, just study the beginning of chapters 3, 4, and 9.
I would tend to throw in the third declension because that determines a lot down the road.
Yeah.
But that could be the ocean beginning to swallow somebody up.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. I call the third declension sometimes, the third declension is a declension from hell.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's sort of a rhyme and reason to the first and second declensions where they at least parallel each other.
Yeah.
Now, the third declension is like, this was like somebody drunk coming up, you know, they had turns coming up with syntax and some guy got drunk when they did the third declension, you know. But third declension is the hidden declension.
Genitive plural, that's the one to hang your head on.
Yeah, the genitive plural ending is always omega nu.
There you go.
Yeah, but see, then sometimes
sometimes
you see own in third declension nominative singular form. So
right, and then it shows up in verbs.
Yeah, that's one thing to know for Greek. There is no one rule that's going to there. As Veltz would say, there's no real silver bullet. That can kill the werewolf.
We should probably transition to our closing segment, which is ripe for the picking or leave it on the tree. I'll go first here. So we explained this before. Ripe for the picking, which means you like it, or leave it on the tree means no thanks. I'm just going to go right for the thing that we have to talk about. The Star Wars franchise. Now, I've heard some people recently say the Star Wars franchise is dead. Kenobi killed the Star Wars franchise. They just keep pumping out all kinds of crazy stuff. The Book of Boba Fett was kind of one step toward death, and Kenobi kind of sealed the deal. Dr. Lewis, I know you're a huge Star Wars fan, but the Star Wars franchise, as it currently stands, ripe for the picking or leave it on the tree?
I'm going to say ripe for the picking.
Okay.
Because I think The Mandalorian can still come back. This is what they say, you know, you hear that Jon Favreau pulled a back muscle. It was from pulling the Star Wars out of the right, you know.
Anything that Jon Favreau does, I'm a huge fan of,
And we watched Book of Boba Fett. It could have been better.
Yeah.
But basically, when The Mandalorian came back in,
it got really good.
It got really good, right?
Exactly.
I mean, didn't it?
And now
we have Baby Yoda choosing the way of the Mandalorian versus the way of the Force. There's got to be more, and then the Kenobi series. It was worth it simply for the final confrontation of him and Darth Vader. It makes sense of their confrontation, the original Star Wars. Last time you were the master, I was, and you don't really see that yet but you see it in that scene where Kenobi beats him again. And I remember my son John and I watched that. He wasn't really a fan, but that one scene we're like, okay, now we understand why Kenobi. And we would also say all the animated versions, you know, like the final death of Darth Maul, where he actually dies a Christian in Obi-Wan's hands because he believes Luke is the Messiah. You know, little Christ imagery in there. I remember we actually wept because, you know, Darth Maul is like one of those bad guys that you actually kind of want to get redeemed, like Darth Vader. And so Obi-Wan redeems, Obi-Wan kills him in a scene that I think is dragged out of the samurai movie Yojimbo. Not Yojimbo, Sanjiro, but where two guys face off on one move and one guy gets killed. And then you have Darth Maul basically finding hope in the fact that Luke is the one. And he dies a Christian in the faith. Yes, you will see Darth Maul in the resurrection of the just, because he's saved by grace through faith and not by his own works.
Come to Concordia Seminary so you can hear Dave Lewis explain movies and how they connect to our Christian faith.
Well, we have a Faith and Film Festival coming up. You can find info for that on the website as well.
For me right now, I'm going to say I'm leaving Star Wars on the tree for the moment.
Okay.
I actually didn't even finish the Kenobi series. You've kind of tipped me off that I need to finish it, but I was so thoroughly bored with it.
Yeah.
That I just left off, and I haven't watched.
I like the actor Ian
McEwan.
Yeah, he's good.
I just like him so much that I'll stay with him even through a bad movie, because he's there. Yeah. So.
I mean, right now I have to pick and choose what I watch. I haven't watched everything Star Wars, not because it's Leave It on the Tree for me, just because I'm a father, I'm a graduate student, I have a full-time job, a part-time job.
Just two characters, Mandalorian and Baby Yoda.
Well, yep. Yeah, no, yep. Mandalorian.
That's why it's right for the pick. Yeah. So.
I was going to ask you a movie one.
Okay.
You know what? It is what it is. Right for the picking or Leave It on the Tree, the new Jurassic Park movies. So this is like Jurassic World and the two that follow. Have you seen Dominion? I saw it.
I haven't seen Dominion. Okay, I saw the first
one. I only watched
it
because I was on an airplane.
The first one, I'll say, right for the picking. I like Chris
Pratt,
and I can enjoy anything he's in.
Sure.
And I like seeing dinosaurs, and I like seeing dinosaurs eat people. So I'm kind of easy to please. I think the original Jurassic Park, I saw that at the Esquire.
Oh, right.
And actually, Dr. Bob Rosine saw it and tore it apart in class. He critiqued it. And so I felt compelled to go with my wife. And I think Spielberg's a great director, and it was a great adventure movie. And so I'm hoping – I haven't seen the next one, though. So
Jurassic
Park. But I'll just say still right for the picking. It could any movie with dinosaurs can easily be redeemed.
Yeah.
I mean, they can go either way, though.
Yeah.
And I watched Dominion on the airplane. It was a Jurassic Park movie, so I don't know if nostalgia is the thing that made me like it was okay. It had a little cheesy moments where I was like, I don't know if you guys.
The first one was ripe for the picking for me. Everything after has just been like Fast and Furious 9.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. It's just another dinosaur movie. They're running from dinosaurs. They've overcome the amusement
to
park.
To which I would say they're running from dinosaurs, but they're running from dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. I mean, I was a big dinosaur fan when I was a little kid.
Same.
And so basically, I remember watching, what was it, 2 Million BC with Raquel Welch, where they have the animatronic, what was the guy's name, Harry Housen, used to have the skeletons from Jason the Argonauts. He had these animatronic dinosaurs, and they're again kind of cheesy animation today, but just fun to watch. Yeah. I was a dinosaur, so I would say because I grew up as a dinosaur fanatic, I wanted to be a paleontologist when I was four, just to dig up dinosaur bones, and so that's in other words, even the cheese factor in the first Jurassic Park, it's like you get the kids survive. They kill off Samuel Jackson, which was messed up. They kill off the British hunter and the lawyer.
But they got Dennis, though.
Yeah.
Dennis Nedry.
Yeah, I know. So, and I was thinking, I was kind of thinking, if they really wanted to do this, they should have killed the kids and let the, but still, dinosaurs. That's, for me, at the end of the day.
The first movie came out, it was like 92, and I was 8. And so it's like I've been growing up with these films.
When the first movie came out, it was just stunning. And the idea was really interesting.
Yeah.
But even like the original like sequels.
I would say none of them stand up to the first.
Yeah, fair.
But I don't know. Yes. Yeah. It's like all the Dirty Harry sequels. None of them are as good as Dirty Harry, but it's Clint Eastwood shooting people.
Yeah.
So
yeah, exactly.
Bang bang.
All right. So next one, we're in the fall season, and when this airs, I think we'll still be in the fall season. College football, ripe for the picking, or Leave It on the Tree.
Okay, I might lose my man card, but I'd say Leave It on the Tree. I've never been into watching sports on television.
Sure. Yeah.
My dad was a sports fanatic. That's all we would have on TV all fall. And it was like he used to smoke cigarettes, and I vowed as a kid, I am never going to smoke cigarettes. And he would spend all day, every weekend, watching college ball.
Yeah.
And I just said, I'm not going to get into this. Mm. And I didn't. I could sit with friends and watch a game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there it's more the social interaction.
Right.
But I just... Yeah, I mean, it's not that I hate it. It's just not for me. I'm not going to spend my time doing it. And I got too much to do anyway. So if I'm going to if I'm going to use my time, I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going to watch a Star Wars movie, not college football. Sorry if that, you know.
I'm kind of in the same place. I think our community knows that I'm a Notre Dame fan, which is kind of hard because they've just been so awful for so long. So it was mostly about my childhood and going to a couple of games at the stadium and seeing Touchdown Jesus, which was kind of a magical moment, but they haven't really been good since 1987 or whatever. So,
well, see, I could watch Rudy anytime.
That's a great
film. Yeah. Oh, man, I love Rudy.
So I might even say like sitting down and watching an entire game is probably Leave It on the Tree even for me.
College football is a Leave It on the Tree for me. I don't have a favorite college team. When people do, I'm like, how? I mean, usually it's attached to like you're from alumni. Some obscure place, even from
my dad in played the country. My dad played college ball for Tennessee.
Oh yeah,
so that was one reason. But then he became a beatnik and encouraged my brother and me not to play.
I'm not gonna lie. I mean, my boys don't like football, but like I still have football injuries.
Yeah,
and I probably would. Discouraging. It's there's in a if they wanted to play football, I wouldn't be like it's too dangerous for you. But there's no way to make football safe,
right?
Or like even less dangerous. And now you're starting to come out with all these CTE things, and you begin to wonder because I had a couple of concussions when I was a kid. Anyway, it kind of took the air out of my next one because it's sports related, but it's not ongoing, so maybe it's different. Right for the pick and Leave It on the Tree. Winter Olympics. Hmm.
I'm going to say right for the picking.
Okay. I was wrong.
I might lose my man card. But for what I like about the Winter Olympics, I like watching the female figure skating.
Sure.
Just women are naturally more graceful than men. I don't like watching the dudes. But my wife is into it. Mm. And so we usually have a favorite, usually American figure skater or Chinese figure skater. And the rest of it I could leave on the tree, but... the female figure skating, it's kind of like gymnastics in Summer Olympics. Female gymnastics is always more interesting than male gymnastics.
Yeah.
Again, just the grace. I don't know. So I don't know if I lose my man card for that either.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't watch a ton of Winter Olympics. If it's on and I happen to, I like to watch like bobsledding and or skeleton. I think it's just insane. Like think like, oh, that'd be fun, and then reality sets in. I'm like, they're tripping. Like that, it's so reckless and dangerous. In Summer Olympics, I just like swimming and track. But
I like swimming. Summer Olympics, I like a lot more.
Yeah.
But when it comes to gymnastics, we like to watch the female gymnastics, and I like to watch the swimming. I like to watch. I remember the 72 Olympics, which is one of the most controversial Olympics of all time. That summer, I think we just watched we watched the Olympics all day.
Sure.
And I remember that was when Mark Spitz got his 7 gold. That was when the American basketball team got the silver against the USSR because they beat them. And then last minute, a Russian timekeeper said there was a minute left. And then the Russians scored, and they beat us by 1. And I think when they did the layup, you see the two Americans have been fouled laying on the ground. And I remember hating communism ever since.
Where were the 72 Olympics? Where were those held?
Munich.
Munich. That and isn't that also where anyway.
Yeah.
Terrorism and things like that. Okay. I mean, it's before my time, so I always have to look at the history annals.
Yeah, it's probably Leave It on the Tree for me. My wife likes Olympics more than me, but if it's on, I will sit in the room and like glance at the TV for 2 minutes, like especially if somebody's doing downhill skiing, either slalom or the jump, I'm amused by that for like 10 seconds, and then I go back to reading about cryptocurrency.
Snowboarding half pipe, I take it back. Snowboarding half pipe is insane as well. Something else that I would, they hurt themselves.
All right, go ahead. Last one for me, right for the picking or Leave It on the Tree. The television sitcom The Office.
I would say right for the picking.
All right. Yeah.
Really like the original British version with Ricky Gervais.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I like the American version,
too. My look-alike, my doppelganger.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what people say. Ricky Gervais and I.
Now that you said it.
Now that you said it. with the beard.
With
him having the beard. Yeah. I would say he looks like more like you than you look like him.
Whoa.
So, but I haven't seen all the American, and I still need to catch up. I'm just behind in a lot of watching, but I think The Office is funny.
So, here's the moment. It's ripe for the picking. I'm actually going to do this.
Oh, it actually looks nice on the inside. I'm Batman.
Unless you want it, Dave.
It does
go ahead.
It does look nice.
See, and like I'm looking at the texture of it, and now I'm nervous.
Can you get that on camera?
Here we go. All right, I'm just.
It's pink inside.
Oh yeah.
But
all right,
it's got a real earthy flavor because the outside is not ripe. Actually,
mine's quite sweet.
Green, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's not ripe enough, and so. The outside, I had one like this a little while ago. It's too unripe, and so it kind of tastes like dirt. So
the texture got me a little bit.
It's sort of ripe. The Office for me is totally ripe for the picking. In fact, my family and I just finished watching through it a second time last night. Do we like The Office in my house? We've watched it through twice.
I'll watch The Office anytime it's on. Yeah. Like, it's easily a top three sitcom of all time for me.
Yeah.
And if I'm, it might be before seasons 8 and 9, I probably would have put it at the top for me.
Season 9, we actually started to understand why it's so zany.
Yeah.
I mean, I could do without Robert California, but other than that.
Oh, really? I think he saves season 8, if you ask me, but anyway.
Season 8 is just kind of rough, but season 9, I think, makes a lot more sense. So I won't go into my whole theory for why season 9 makes sense. But,
okay.
It's right for the picking for you, too.
Yeah. Oh, I love The Office. Yeah, it's such a good show. But yeah, I won't harp on why I think it's so good, but it is the character development as things go on, the different dynamics of The Office and how things play out and how they, you know, sometimes a sitcom goes on for a long time and it just moves forward and things from the past become completely irrelevant, but they have a very clever way of
the writing is amazing,
putting things right back in that you forgot about, and then you get the nostalgia from early, like it. They're very clever, and I appreciate that, which, well, anyway, Parks and Rec would be up there for me as well, kind of along the same lines. All right. Right for the pick and leave it on the tree. And I like to throw food ones in there just because I'm such a foodie person. Rhubarb.
Ooh. Mm. Right for the pick and. Yeah, my family in Wyoming used to grow rhubarb in their gardens.
Okay.
And my grandma and my aunt Floribel, who's married to my uncle Sam, used to make rhubarb pie, and then my Aunt Floribel would also make rhubarb strawberry pie and rhubarb cherry pie.
Okay.
And I think my favorite pie actually in the world would be a rhubarb pie with heated up with a scoop of vanilla ice cream.
Mm. Okay.
My mom could make rhubarb pie very well, too. I remember we went to Wyoming, we're driving back to California, and you know, I don't know if you know, when you enter California, they got these stations to check if you have any fruit or vegetables. And she admitted that we had rhubarb, and the guy was going to confiscate it. And then she
contraband.
Contraband. So she said, "Well, you're just going to take it home, and your wife's going to make rhubarb pie." So she took it, and still on the Arizona side of the border, I think it was the Nevada side of the border, and she walked off the road and then dumped it in the dirt, rolled it around in the dirt, then put it back in the bag and came up back and gave it to him. And she said, "If I can't have it, you can't have it." And
take that.
Yeah, that was my mom. She was
that's awesome. Yeah,
Wyoming cowgirl.
Hey,
and I love rhubarb. That's easily right for the picking
for me too. My mom and my aunt would make we love rhubarb pie, rhubarb and strawberry pie, awesome. But also, my mom and aunt made this thing called rhubarb dream squares.
Oh yeah,
which was kind of like an egg white sugar top, and it would kind of crisp up, but it was kind of like a lemon bar, but made with rhubarb.
Yep. Okay,
amazing. Yep. I could eat an entire pan.
Yep.
No problem.
I know about those too. So.
Yeah.
I had rhubarb for the first time after meeting Dorothy.
Wow.
Because rhubarb is one of her favorites. And I remember when she was first describing to me, she was like, it's like red celery. And I was like, well, why would that taste good?
Insanely bitter.
Yeah.
but then she was like, I'm going to... So she made a strawberry rhubarb crumble.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I was like, all right, this is... Yeah. Yeah. So it's... I mean, it's right for the pick. I like it.
Yeah.
But it's not like I don't have any of that attachment to it because I had it for the first time when I was 25. It's just
It's like what's the show with Ratatouille where where you eat it and it takes you back to your childhood.
Yep. Yeah,
that is what rhubarb does for me. Yeah. I'm like 3 years old and I'm eating rhubarb dream squares and everything in the world is right.
Yeah, it's one of the ultimate comfort foods.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah,
exactly.
Just brings me back to,
that's good to know.
Our visits to Wyoming to my grandma, frying chicken, and then making rhubarb pie.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, again, for our viewers, listeners, please let us know about any ideas that you have for Ripe for the Picking or Leave It Under the Tree. I'll use them. Mike probably already has a million things on his list, but my list is I keep on getting to the end of my list, so I need some ideas.
I have so many that I've never asked anybody.
Yeah, it is... Winter Olympics, that was a good one.
Yeah,
this is
my Ripe for the Picking or Leave It on the Tree list.
Yeah, listeners, help me out. Seriously, I need some serious help here.
It's just going well. Dr. Lewis is always, thanks for coming on the show with us. It's always one of those things where it's like learning Greek. Just as you go, you bring a different nuance to the show for us, a different direction, and bring things to life. Probably at some point, maybe we should just have you on dedicated to talk about faith in film, because I think our listeners would really appreciate that. Any last little piece of advice that you might have for anybody that's kind of like around or maybe beginning to approach their discernment process, thinking about becoming a church worker?
Yeah, I would say talk to the people in your life whom you trust. I mean, one of the reasons I came to the seminary was I had a lot of people tell me that I should.
Yeah.
My parents, pastors, other people at church, family members, friends. And so I would say don't just keep it to yourself, but actually mention this to your pastor, to your parents, and listen to their counsel and their guidance. In other words, likely, if there are a lot of people in your life telling you that you ought to be a pastor or a deaconess, there's a good chance you should, right? That God is using those people to put this upon your heart.
Yeah.
And that's what that would be my advice. Talk to the people you trust and listen to them.
That's excellent.
Yep. Yep. And as always, if you're listening and you're not thinking about it, but you're a listener and you see somebody in your congregation that you know that you think should be, do the same because, again, you never know. Seeds get planted, and they go. Well, again, thank you for thank you for coming on and joining us.
Good to be. Thank you for inviting me. It's always fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you're listening and you're thinking about it, and let us know who you are. And in fact, still going on in the linked in description of the episode on the podcast, or at least on the YouTube page. If you go to www.csl.edu/admissions, you can get to our request for information, but the link is on the YouTube page. And if we don't know who you are currently and you submit your information through the page, we'll send you a copy of Sculpt Your Spirit by Dr. Leopoldo Sanchez. Please like the episode on YouTube, share it with people around you. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time under the fig tree.